I think I'm going to call us to order. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And it's my duty first to announce that we appear to have lost the ambassador from speaking today. Called away for other duties, which I regret. We believe Reuben Marion Benjamin will still be here. We're trying to track him down. As many of you know, there are visitors in town, and whenever there are visitors in town, mission and embassy people tend to get preoccupied. So we'll hope that Mr. Benjamin is still going to be with us. We have, however, two very distinguished people in the person of Ambassador Tim Carney, Ambassador David Shin. And this event is an event, a culminating event in a way, for a big project in which Tim in particular has been importantly involved in writing the report. It's a big project that involved interviewing nearly 100 people who were involved in negotiating and implementing the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, this rather extraordinarily large, very comprehensive peace agreement that so far has, at least you can say, it has held the peace, though there are obvious the enormous difficulties in its implementation. It includes, I'm told, I didn't count them, 1,100 specific things that people have to do. And that's a lot of things that people have to do. Implementation hasn't been easy. We're all aware that the participation of the Southern Sudanese in the Khartoum government has been suspended since October 11th. There are clear indications that that problem will hopefully soon be in the past, but the problems of negotiation and implementation of this agreement are clearly worthy of careful study. And Tim Carney is the man who, in a way, did that careful study by reading almost 100 interviews, which are now posted on our website so that others may read them as well, and preparing a report suggesting that some assembly is required in putting together a peace agreement like this and making it work. Tim has done this wonderful report, which is available to you outside. We'll start with Tim Carney. Tim?
Should I speak from here? Or
you can speak from there.
That. It might be a little more user-friendly. I'm delighted to be back in harness with David Shin. He was the director of East African Affairs at the State Department. Is this not on?
Maybe bring it closer.
Yeah, right. Thanks. Better? Ah, good. I'm delighted to be back in harness with David Shin. He was the director of East African Affairs when I went off to Khartoum in August of 1995 as ambassador. And he was with me when we called on then Foreign Minister Ali Uthman Mohamed Taha on the 6th of February, I think it was, of 1996 to have the first serious conversation the United States had had about terrorism. Apache Don Peterson here, you did talking points. We actually had a chat with now second Vice President Taha. Dan mentioned that there were almost 100 interviews. There were, and I took the task on my way out of the country on vacation into a very remote part of the world. And at my wife's brilliant suggestion, because there was only 3 hours of electricity a day at this remote location, I printed the interviews out. Turned out to be 1,250 pages, which caused a certain amusement at Kinko's when I went over with a CD-ROM. And that leads to an observation on the report itself. There aren't any footnotes in it, you might have noticed, and all you academics and students are undoubtedly quailing or maybe even quivering with joy at the thought of doing a 9,000-word report that doesn't have any footnotes. I don't like it that way, frankly. I would much rather have footnotes, partly because you can trade, well, you know all the reasons to have footnotes. That's the bad news. The good news is I could easily commingle my own opinion and views with those of those who were interviewed without any necessary attribution. Although one of the USIP reviewers did ask, is this Carney or is it the interviewers or the interviewees? And I'll let you all judge that when you get a chance to look at this. I'm not going to talk about the history of Sudan. If you don't know the history of Sudan, you can read about it. What I'm going to focus on, and I think that will be the value of this gathering, is that we'll look at what to do, at what we might recommend and what we might suggest as a way forward in the current situation. And let me summarize the recommendations in the report and tweak them slightly. The first one is that we need to increase international engagement in ensuring that the CPA is actually implemented. And I would divide that engagement into two parts. The first is the larger international community. That includes the entity called the Troika Plus, U.S., U.K., Norway, and Italy. That entity, and I believe through the Norwegians, has an important role in that the last I recall, there is a key body that the CPA creates. It's known as the AEC, and that is somebody. Can somebody parse the A for me? Assessment and Evaluation Commission. Thank you very much. And that's a very important body. And by all that I have read, and all of the interviewees were consistent in arguing that the AEC had not adequately fulfilled its possible role. Remember, with all these roles, there's what's written down in paper, and then there's what you might do if you're actually running the body. And the AEC seems to me to need some heavy kick-starting. Not only do you need the Troika Plus engaged, but looking further from Sudan, I would argue that you need both, and I'll put it in a sort of academic manner, and you'll see what I mean, both Muslim and non-Muslim Asia engaged. And guess what non-Muslim Asia is, for anyone who knows where Beijing is. And the Chinese, of course, have a potential role, and they have moved to begin playing it. When I'm in Khartoum, and I haven't been in Khartoum in almost 2 years now, there are an awful lot of Sudanese of various ethnic backgrounds. I learned that you can't say tribe anymore. At least the anthropologists will all jump on you if you try to, that basically believe that they need to give up on the West, that it's Asia that counts. The Asians, the Indians, the Chinese, the Malaysians are buying the oil. And so the West, well, this is obviously runs counter to what most Sudanese really believe. Most Sudanese see Sudan as part of a much larger world, and a world that is heavily invested in the educational and academic aspects of what the West has to offer. Now, who's next for international engagement? Well, it would be the region, of course, because you'll recall that the CPA was negotiated in the context of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, with a major mediating role by General Lazaro Sumbawa, former chief of Kenya's army. Now, Kenya is in a complicated situation now. I believe we've got elections coming, if I'm not mistaken, and it may not be possible for the Kenyans to engage, but I would submit that we definitely need to have IGAD back in helping implement the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. Of the The second recommendation focuses on what in terms of CPA instrumentalities needs to happen vitally, and that is essentially the midterm elections now set for 2009. The consensus that I gleaned is that these elections carry within themselves the possibility of enhancing the legitimacy of both of the authorities, the northern and the southern, a legitimacy which is at this point essentially draws from the barrel of a gun in both the north and the south. That essentially you've got some problems right now, some vital difficulties for trying to run these elections. You don't have the borders properly delimited. You don't have the internally displaced Sudanese nor the refugees returned home. So you don't know what size a constituency should be, much less where your constituencies should be located. Now, IFES people, and I have an association with IFES that goes back a long way, IFES people tell me that you can organize elections without necessarily doing all that, but you need to be creative and imaginative, and more importantly, you need to be in agreement, both north and south, and within the states that make up Sudan, if you're going to try to do that. A third recommendation is one that draws on my own history in international peacekeeping efforts, and it concerns media. My impression is that while there's been a fairly strong effort to enhance the media capability of the government of South Sudan, it's pretty anemic, especially when you get outside the cities and the towns. In the north of Sudan, Fadl. Welcome. Ken Carney. Be comfortable. Now, in the north of Sudan, my impression, and subject to correction that may come out in our discussions, the CPA is pretty well known among urban and student and political elite populations, but if you go out much outside of Atbara or Khartoum or El Obeid, if you go to Umdalem, a village that the Sahara was taking over when I was there 4 years ago, they knew about Iraq 4 years ago, but they may not know as much about the CPA as they ought to. So I would argue there needs to be a heavy focus on explaining the CPA more urgently to the Sudanese people at large. Just to conclude by looking at a few issues, I don't think there's any doubt that the focus on Darfur has blurred the attention to realizing and implementing the CPA. It seems that's probably a no-brainer. And as one of the things that's happened there is you've got two clever foreigners, two clever by half, that is, foreigners, arguing with each other. I mean, this is particularly unproductive, if not autoerotic. The object is to get something done in Sudan, not to get foreigners arguing with each other on what to do about Sudan. And the bottom line is, all the foreigners agree that the CPA has within itself the framework that might produce resolution of all of the issues between the periphery and the center, which is to say between Darfur and the riverine Afro-Arab population in Khartoum, between the east, the Beja and Khartoum, between Nubia and Khartoum, and as it does, of course, between the south and Khartoum. That seems to me to be a good, broad agreement to work from so that the foreigners can see first recommendation, enhance their engagement in making the process real. And last, there's a broader question here, and it's one that figured in part of the negotiations for the CPA itself. And that is whether you need to resolve the differences of approach in the CPA on a sort of one-by-one, one-at-a-time approach, or whether you need a much larger package approach to go at it. In other words, do you look at ABIE? Do you look at joint integrated units? Do you look at disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration separately? Or do you try to do some kind of a package that would include one or more of these and a number of other issues as well? And I'm pleased that I don't have to answer that question, that I can throw it out to the audience, to all of us here, and we might talk more further about it. Thanks.
Thank you, Tim. For Reuben's benefit, I might say that Tim, at the beginning of his remarks, emphasized the importance of international engagement, especially of what he called Muslim and non-Muslim Asia. He emphasized the importance of the midterm elections in 2009 as a means of enhancing legitimacy for both the government in the South and for Khartoum. And then he proceeded to media, and you heard, I think, his remarks on media. David?
I thought I was going to do cleanup.
Oh, you were going to be last. That's my mistake. But could we give Reuben a little breather, too? To get his thoughts together, and then I think it might be better.
Well, I was hoping to sort of bat number four on the roster here, so that I could comment on what had been said by others primarily. But having been asked to speak now, let me tack a little bit differently. First, in terms of Tim's report. Or the USIP report, which I have had an opportunity to read with some care, I have no real exception to it. I think the analysis is sound, and I think the recommendations are fine. In fact, the only statement that I ran across that jarred me a little bit, and maybe Tim could comment on this at some point this afternoon, was that neither the National Congress Party nor the SPLM or A currently commands popular legitimacy. I guess I can understand why the NCP does not command popular legitimacy, and I certainly appreciate that the SPLM and the SPLA has a number of problems in the South. But it struck me as maybe being a bit strong to say that the SPLM and A does not have popular legitimacy. But I think Tim can respond to that. But I really don't. I don't see any need to comment further on the analysis or the recommendations because they struck me as being perfectly fine. What I'd like to do is give some of my reactions to what is going on in the South based on having followed Sudan going back to the early 1980s and having been engaged with it sporadically ever since. And I would start with the view that I was very optimistic when the CPA was agreed upon and signed off in January of 2005. I thought it really did offer a new lease on life for bringing this very difficult situation in Sudan that dates back to 1955 to an end. Having said that, as someone who did a fairly major study on the 1972 peace agreement, I was not horribly optimistic that it was going to go according to plan because, as it turned out, the 72 agreement was a major disappointment. And my fear was that a lot of the same would happen following the 2005 CPA. And to some extent, I think those fears have been or are being borne out as we sit here today. For the CPA to work, there really does have to be a political commitment by all the parties, a very deep and abiding commitment. And I'm not sure that we've seen that, quite frankly, by either side up to this point. The SPLM, SPLA, has put out a list of portions of the CPA that it claims have not been carried out so far, and I might take just a second to mention those. I don't know whether Ruben was going to go through them or not, but I think for the purpose of the audience, it's useful to know where the sticking points seem to be for the moment. Many of these issues are the same kinds of issues that one could have cited in the post-1972 agreement, some of the same precise issues in some instances. One of the big differences being that you didn't have oil back in 1972, so oil was not a factor then. But otherwise, there's a little bit of deja vu going on. But having said that, the fault is certainly not exclusively with the North. And I think there are some real concerns as to whether the South has gone into the CPA really committed for its part to try to make unity work. And my hope was that that is what would come out of the CPA, that the North would take all of the steps necessary to ensure that it could convince the Southern population that it was in their interest to remain part of a unified Sudan, perhaps with a significant amount of autonomy. That probably was inevitable, but nevertheless still a single Sudanese state. And the reason I've felt that way, and I may be in something of a minority on this, on that point of view, is that I've long been concerned that even a secessionist southern Sudan is not the end of divisions in Sudan. And based on what has happened in Darfur more recently, I'm convinced more than ever that if there is a totally independent southern Sudan, the chances are very high of further divisions in both the North and the South, to the point that I think you get to a situation that is not really tenable for any of the parties concerned. And I hope that doesn't happen. I hope I'm wrong on that score. I was in Khartoum, also in Addis Ababa, and in Cairo for about 4 weeks this summer in July. And even though I was there primarily working on research dealing with China-Africa relations, I certainly had an opportunity to discuss the whole issue of the CPA pretty widely in all three of those capitals. And everywhere I went, the view was unanimous that the Southerners are headed towards secession. I encountered no one, frankly, among the Southern population who had a different point of view. There were a few of my northern contacts that thought, no, it's still a possibility to have a unified Sudan, and we're still working in that direction. I'm not sure I sensed a great deal of commitment to that point of view, but I did hear it from several northerners. But when I left the region, I left with a view that the South is headed towards secession, a sort of end of matter. And that really does start raising then a whole series of questions in one's mind. What happens in the 2009 elections? Are there elections in 2009? And the people that I was talking to, some of whom have traveled extensively in southern Sudan and also in the north and have good contacts on both sides, had serious reservations as to whether there would be elections in 2009. Assuming that, obviously, you ideally want to have a census, you want to have various other things that happened before the elections, there's very little progress being made on that score. But if you do have reasonably good elections in 2009, you then have to get ready for the 2011 referendum, in which only the Southerners would vote in order to determine whether they wanted an independent southern Sudan or they wanted to remain federated or linked in some capacity with the North. All of that seemed to me to be a very long way away in terms of reaching any kind of satisfactory solution. And it was only a few weeks after I left the region that the SPLM announced that it had withdrawn its ministers from the national government until certain conditions had been met in terms of implementing the CPA, and that problem has not resolved itself since. If anything, in my view, it's gotten worse. You're now having these mutual recriminations going on between the SPLM on the one hand and the foreign ministry in Khartoum on the other as to whether the visit to Washington by Salwa Kiir was authorized or not authorized. It depends upon whom you read as to whom you might believe, and I don't make any judgment on that. I don't know who's right. But it's not good. It's just a very, very messy situation at the moment. And I don't really see anyone dealing with it in a manner to make it less messy. So I approach the CPA with a very heavy heart because I have felt for quite some time now that the CPA was, quite frankly, a more important issue than Darfur. And that may come as a great shock to most of you in this room. But I think that the potential for doing damage against large numbers of people, Sudanese, is greater with a total breakdown of the CPA than what has happened so far in Darfur. And I don't think, at least until very recently perhaps, that the international community has been giving the kind of attention to the CPA that it deserves and that it needs, in part because Darfur has effectively sucked the oxygen out of the air in the Horn of Africa. Now, that may be changing. In the last couple of weeks, there has been more attention on the CPA, which is good. A little late, mind you, but it's good. I still, even with this very recent attention focused on the CPA, cannot find myself to accept that anything is happening that is causing this energy, this relatively newfound energy, to direct the CPA in a direction that will achieve its either revitalization or whatever has to happen to it. And of course, there is the real problem that if I'm right, and if the Southerners have effectively already decided for independence, then it raises all of the very nasty questions as to, well, what will the Northern government do in order to prevent particularly control over oil resources from going with the South? And I will leave to your imagination, perhaps, what that might entail, but it would, in my mind, be a very, very difficult outcome. So that's not a very upbeat look at the situation based on a relatively brief visit to the region in July, based on having followed Sudan issues pretty much continuously since 1983, and based on someone who has a deep and abiding interest in the Horn of Africa, and particularly peace and stability in the Horn of Africa. I sense that we are at a real crossroads with the CPA. And unless there is an enormous willingness to compromise by the parties directly concerned, and unfortunately this is also getting wrapped up with the Darfur problem to some extent, and it's not easy to separate the CPA from what is going on in Darfur, but unless this can be done, and can be done relatively quickly, I do not see a good outcome. So let me stop there, and perhaps Reuben can give you an uplifting retort.
Thank you, David, also for going somewhat out of order. You've done it beautifully. In fact, you've set Reuben up for some tough questions about, in particular, about attitudes in the South, both governmental attitudes and popular attitudes. Reuben, the floor is yours.
First of all, I would like to apologize. I think you owe me two apologies that I came late, and the reason was that
you could speak up a little bit.
Right. Yeah. The reason was that President Salva Kiir was preparing himself to meet President Bush, and there were some meetings going on in the hotel, and I got caught somewhere there. And another apology is on behalf of Dr. Luca Byom, the Minister Luca Byom. He is actually also one of the delegates that going to the White House at the same time with this session. and he just asked me yesterday to substitute him, and it has been a terrible night for me to try to prepare myself in about 19 or 20 hours so that I can come here and present something that really tangible to the audience. Ladies and gentlemen, when we are speaking about the peace agreement, we are talking about the Machakos Protocol, power sharing between the government at that time and the SPLM, and also wealth sharing between the government at that time and the SPLM, and then the Abia resolution, and then the two-state resolution, Southern Kordofan and the Luba Mountain and the Blue Nile. Lastly, and security arrangements. This is the CPA that we are talking today. We in the SPLM, we have known the attitude of our partners right there from the beginning in 2005, when we were trying to divide the important and the powerful ministries among us. By then, there was two ministries online, the finance and the foreign affairs. We gave them the first chance to choose. They've chosen the finance, and then we say, okay, we'll take the foreign affairs. The second round was between two ministries. That is the mining and energy ministry and the interior ministry. The first choice was for us to choose the SPLM. We said yes, we want to take the petroleum ministry so that we manage it. And right there, the attitude and the behavior rise right away, and they said no, we're going to take that ministry. And then we asked them, what about the interior ministry? They said also, we're going to take it all, both of them. Then it was clear for us that these people, the partners are not honest, and they don't have a political will to implement the CPA. Since then, we went into the problems with them, and at the end, we reached to this deadlock today. The wealth up to today, we don't know really what is the total of the oil that we get, and what's the amount that we also get. They said we have 50-50 according to the agreement, but 50 from what really is not clear for us, and they don't tell us because we were just coming out from the bush. We don't have expert in this in the fields to monitor what's going on in the oil field and what's going on in the market. So they take this opportunity and try to lash us right away from there. That's another dispute. Then the Abia protocol, there was a very big dispute there, and the United States came in and say no and present something that we and the partners to agree on, and then we were expelled to agree on that, and the Abia Protocol came out. According to the Abia Protocol, we should just go and conduct the boundaries, the demarcation of the boundaries first, and then set up the administration in the area. But our partners refused and said they must set up the administration first and then boundaries at the end. And we say, no, how come you set up the administration on a boundary that is unknown? Who is going to really, you're going to administer it at the end of the day? You don't know the boundary of the area that you can administer. Americans came in and solved that problem, and we had formed the Commission of ABI boundaries. Those international experts came out with the result that yes, ABI belongs to Denkan Ngok of Northern Barra Lazal. Our partner disputed the result by saying that the international expert has overstepped their mandate. When we ask them what kind of mandate, they don't tell us what mandate that the international expert has succeeded. Before the President Salva Kiir journeyed to the U.S., they met with President Bashir in Khartoum, and they tried to narrow the differences, but ABI problem remains as it is. President Kiir and President Bashir agreed that the resolutions of their meetings, President Bashir will issue the executive orders so that we go immediately to the implementation of the CPA. And then President Kiir came here. Up to now, we didn't hear about the executive orders that the President should order. And on our side, we consider it as just a delay of implementation of the CPA. And there were a lot of meetings before the President Salva Kiir came to the United States. Those meetings actually were just like a night, just a political symposium without resolutions. This such political symposium without resolution and debating without reaching to a certain point actually does not work with us in the SPLM. So the SPLM issued to stop the ministry, the ministers in the government of national unity not to function as ministers and ministers and presidential advisors. They went back and they are staying now on the houses until the further notice. The further notice will be when the Bashir and his colleagues decides to be serious in implementation of the CPA. If they are not going to respond to our demands, then the people were which you mentioned a while ago, then we will go to the Plan B. And the Plan B we have is actually is not on sale at this time. It will be out on the time that we choose, and will be known to all of you. In the security arrangements, according to the CPA, it's supposed for the SAF, the Sudan Armed Forces, to withdraw thy forces from southern Sudan to northern Sudan by the end of the 9th of July 07. Until this time I'm talking to you, the government forces are still in the oil fields, they are still in southern Sudan, and especially concentrating on in the Upper Nile region. And that's a violation of the CPA. In Sudan, at this time, we have three armies. There's the SAF, belongs to the government, and the SPLA, that's the political arms wing for the SPLM, the military wing for the SPLM, and then the Joint Integrated Units Army. Those joint integrated units are both from the SPLA and the Sudan Armed Forces. At this time, we were expecting the Northern Army or the SAF Army that should remain in southern Sudan should be those members of the integrated forces, not another soldier. But in the oil fields now, you have the SAF army that are there, and then there is a new force called a force that to protect the oil fields. We don't understand in the south whether are the militias or are the army that belongs to the NCP. But we are monitoring them, and we know where they are in the south. And we have set forward our complaints to the UN, to the friends of the IGAD, members of the IGAD. And now, some forces has been moved away from the south, 12 miles away from the south to north, and then. The SPLA also were somewhere, also they moved back 12 miles back in the south. The availability of the Northern Army or the SAF in southern Sudan, up to this moment, it is a violation of the agreement itself. So our partners are addicted to violate agreement since the agreement was signed. Our positions in all these things is that we are full out from the government of national unity. We are pressuring the NCP to accept the RBA report so that the problem is solved, and then immediately we face the coming elections in 2009. Of course, all we are doing now is to dig a ground, to put a concrete ground for democratic transformation in Sudan. We see it is very crucial and important that if the CPA is implemented fully, then the elections will take place on time, and then the result of the election will be the transformation, the democratic transformation in the Sudan. Some people may ask, maybe the SPLM have moved out or pulled out from the national government, and maybe the plan B is a war or plan D until the end. Actually, we are not planning to go to the war in any time. We are concentrating on implementation of the CPA. If the CPA is implemented fully and honestly, then we are the winners. We are the winners at the end. The objects that we're going to gain by war, we can just get it also if the CPA is implemented fully, really. So we are not interested in fighting. Our position is to pressure our partners to implement the CPA fully, and then we go to election. SPLM is everywhere in the north now. Maybe it's the only party that is popular in the north, and it is well organized in the north, better than in southern Sudan. You get SPLM offices everywhere, members are everywhere in the whole Sudan. That means if the elections takes place, then we are the winners. Lastly, the Darfur. We in the SPLM, we consider the Darfurians as freedom fighters. They have rights to defend themselves. They have rights to use any tools that they see can provide them security, peace in Sudan. Therefore, we are trying to help them. Our help that we offer to the freedom fighters in Darfur is that there are now about 27 factions. There are actually 28. One is in Khartoum, the mini Minawi, and the rest are still struggle. We are trying to bring them together so that to have one agenda and then face the government that which we are a partner in it, so that they come out with their rights. Now in Juba there are six factions. They already agree. They have united, and they are trying to call for the rest to come and unite themselves and face the negotiations while they are united. It has happened to us before when we were in the bush. When we were divided, the government forces shifts us away from the south to the borders of neighbors like Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia. But when we reunited ourselves again, now we become stronger and we fought back and we achieved the CPA which we are talking today. Because of that unity. This is what we are telling our brothers and the freedom fighters in Darfur. Use this experience and take it very seriously so that they unite themselves and negotiate with the government so that they reach the agreement that they want. But from here, from this platform, I would like to tell the freedom fighters in Darfur that don't allow anybody to tell you that use this tool so that you liberate yourself. Look into the advice that are from the friends, from brothers, and then see what is good for you. And take it very seriously and use it, then you will be fine in the future. This briefly is the situation in Sudan, and that's our position as an SPLM. I didn't mention the government of Southern Sudan is not a part of this. This is the pull out from the government is the SPLM who pulled out from the government of national unity. It is the SPLM also. We signed the agreement with the government of Sudan in 2005. I will stop here.
Thank you, Ruben. You've given us a lot to think about. I I'm tempted to ask Don Peterson, who sits in the front row, whether he has any news for us on Abye. Is there any update that we should hear?
No, really. There's nothing to know. I was in Abye. I was in Juba.
Don, stand up at least, or maybe go to the microphone there, which is...
I was in Juba less than 2 months ago. Five so-called experts were asked to go there to brief the Southern Sudanese on how we had arrived at our decision, how we answered the charge that we had exceeded our mandate, and to further explain to the notables of the government of Southern Sudan what the whole process was. We did that, and they were very enthusiastic about it. But certainly my own view, and it was a very limited time there, a few days, talking to everybody I could, there was no optimism about not only Abye, but about the CPA. And I think David's points are well taken. It's going to take a sea change in attitude in the north and to a degree in the south both, to be able to move out of the impasse and stitch something together in a strong way that can overcome the viziparous tendencies that exist between north and south. There's still a possibility, but things do not look very good, at least as I saw it on the ground in Juba 2 months ago.
Thank you, Don. For those who don't know, Ambassador Peterson chaired the, was it called an arbitration commission?
No, Abye Boundaries Commission.
Boundaries Commission. The Abye Boundaries Commission, which has rendered a decision which is supposed to be binding on the parties. Our microphones are open for those who want to engage with the speakers. Please. To the microphone. It's much better if you're at the microphone and introduce yourself first, please.
My name is Salah. I'm deputy chief of mission, Embassy of Sudan in Washington, D.C. Thanks for this elaborate description of the CPA. I have some reservations on what is on the report itself. It's not just this is my personal feeling that the report has said that the NCP does not have the will to implement the CPA. At the same time, and when it goes in this particular summary, they judge our partners by other yardstick. It's not the CPA, which is quite unusual in such a report. I do agree with Ambassador Shin that both parties have a responsibility in the implementation. And when we are saying that one party has the responsibility to implement, neglecting the other party, this is not going to the way forward for the implementation of the CPA. There are so many things has been said by our colleagues here. I don't have the time to reply to all of them, but I think that setting conditions, threatening with plans, P or A or so, is not going to take us forward in the implementation of the CPA. Also withdrawing from the government of national unity is an obstacle rather than enhancing the implementation of the CPA. Our colleague here also elaborated on the security measures that the government of Sudan has not withdrawn its forces from the south. I just asked him, what is the position of the, where are the forces of the SPLM? The government of Sudan has redeployed its forces from five parts of the southern Sudan, and now they are in the petroleum areas. The SPLM has three locations in the Sudan, and they have just redeployed from one and leaving they have forces in two places. What they are saying is that we cannot redeploy our forces because the government of Sudan did not provide us with the logistical support. The CPA doesn't comply with the government of Sudan to provide this logistical support. And also, again, I say that when you deploy your forces there, you didn't ask for the assistance of the government of Northern Sudan. So why are you now, when you are going to redeploy your forces, you are asking for the assistance of the government of North Sudan. Sometimes they say that we have also the rainy season is there, which is also applied to the south. They say also that we have limited number of forces in these two areas, in North Sudan, in the Blue Nile, and in the Nuba Mountains. If you have limited support, this is easy for you to pull them out, and you put the other party on the stake that is not implementing. But when you are having your forces in two places, and you are just now saying that the government has not redeployed its forces, this is not going to take us anywhere. Also, that saying putting the blame on the one party, while there are, as you have said, 11 tasks on both parties, this is not going to just you blame. Is it the NCP that has to implement all these 1100s? Where are their obligations? Are they meeting them in all of these things? Are they meeting them? They are not. They are not. And this is why we say that for the international community, for those who are concerned with peace, for those concerned with the implementation of the CPA, please put the blame on both parties. Where they fall, you tell this. If you are not going to do that, and you are going to say that SPLM is not implementing because of the capacity or because of lack of... This is an agreement. It's a legal binding agreement. And if you are not up to your commitments, why you committed yourself from the beginning? If you have committed yourself to certain obligations, you have to answer them, and you have to fulfill them. And when you fulfill them, then you put the other party on the stake that is not implementing. In all these things, they are far behind. And I like very much of the analysis of Mr. Sheen that the blame is on both parties. And if we are looking forward, we should tell each party where they are falling, why, and we try to facilitate the implementation of the CPA. In the recent visit of the UN Secretary General to Sudan, he said that, correctly, that both parties are far behind the schedules of the implementation. This is a correct statement. We accept that. But trying to shift the blame on the government on one side, while we have a legal binding agreement with obligations on both parties, this is not going to lead us anywhere, and it's not going to put us in the implementation, and we look for other ingredients of the CPA. You cannot have elections without all other things, and this is not going to be a one-party show. Thank you.
Thank you. Tim, do you want to reply on even-handedness, and then maybe Ruben on this some of the specific questions about security forces?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Let me first comment on Ambassador Shin's puzzlement over my remark that neither side commands legitimacy, and I confess that he has exposed my sloppy mental shorthand in using that term. I regard legitimacy as something that has to be tested formally, and neither side has formally tested its popularity. And believe me, the SPLM definitely has popularity in the South, and indeed, frankly, the National Congress Party has a good bit of popularity in the North. But neither side, in my view, despite several elections in the North, Mr. Salaha, has tested that popularity through broad, free, and fair elections. And that's what I see the 2009 midterm elections as being the beginning of that transformation that the entire country needs. Now, on the notion of, let's call it even-handedness, the report makes clear there is a concern on the part of many in the South, in the North, and the international community that the NCP lacks the political will. Doesn't say that political will isn't there.
It says that the CPA has not. It says that.
Well, I don't think so. If you parse it, you won't. I don't believe you'll find that there.
I'll give it to you, sir.
Oh, I have it right here.
This one.
Yes. The summary reads, slow implementation of key provisions is causing Sudanese to question the political will. That's the key. And I'm delighted to hear your affirmation that the political will is there. But the questions will continue, as indeed will the questions about the capacity of the government of South Sudan, some of which your point brought forth. Well, you can't do everything in a report. In any case, I think the paper also notes the Secretary General's criticism of both parties for failing to realize the schedule of redeployment. And I believe Ban Ki-moon was quite emphatic about that. But I think the bottom line here is that neither side should be engaging in tactical and debating points, but rather both sides, with the assistance of the international community, should be engaging in efforts to move forward and implement this agreement. That criticizing one another ultimately has wonderful tactical advantage. Supporters all over the world are delighted. You get Mr. or Mrs. X or Y, an NGO, A or B, delighted at all this slanging and criticism. But it's not getting the job done. And the job is realizing the CPA.
Ruben?
Thank you. Brother Salah actually was mostly commenting.
If you can speak up a little, Ruben, I think it's hard for people to hear.
He was just commenting mostly, but he has some about three questions that I pick up from his speech, really. And I can realize that as a Sudanese like him, that in the Sudanese politics, since the independence, 1956, there's a part in Sudan that has been always relying on lies, and when this party speaks, really, you feel that there are so many words there are lies, and then you pick up a little bit this realistic in the talks. Now he said, we are threatening with the plan B. It is not a threat, Salah. Tell your government we are serious. If you are not serious about implementation with the CPA, we are serious. That's why we took this decision, so that you know we are serious and we are genuinely want the peace, the agreement to be implemented very seriously. If your party is lacking the political will to genuinely implement the CPA, and then we took a decision on our side as their spellam, and then you said it's a threat. It is not a threat. It is a part of that to show you and the rest of the world and the friends who were around the CPA that there is something wrong going on in Sudan these days. It is not a threat. We are serious. You also ask, where are the forces of the SPLM right now? The forces of the SPLM that are in the north right now is that the 3,000 which are in the Blue Nile and the Nuba Mountain. And these two states have in the agreement that these two states should remain with the 3,000 in Blue Nile and 3,000 from you guys and 3,000 from us, the SPLA. The same thing in the Blue Nile. Then the 6,000 troops will be in one state. This is where you find the SPLA soldiers there. In the north, we don't have the SPLA soldiers there. We have them in northern Upper Nile ring area, where you are behind us about 50 miles in the oil fields, in Koradar, in northern Upper Korflus. This is where you are. You shouldn't be there by the end of the 9th, July the 9th. You shouldn't be there, but you're there. So be serious and tell the world that you're doing something that is in the CPA. He also asked, that we asked for assistance to withdraw our troops. It is true. We asked the government of national unity to provide logistic means so that we took back the forces that we were having in Eastern Sudan, in Umm Shukrayb and the other areas of Eastern Sudan. Because we don't have the capacity. We are just, as you used to call us, we were just rebels. We don't have money to buy trucks and move the tanks and this big military hardware. So we said, oh, since we are Sudanese, okay, we go to our government and then let them help us so that this will make the security arrangement easier for all of us. But it turns out as if we are talking from another nation, not Sudan. This thing cannot happen anywhere except Sudan. That we, the Sudanese, we ask ourselves to help ourselves, and then you refuse. At the end, you make it as a blame. That's not good. In this Sudan that we're talking, I just want to take a moment to tell something about the way Salah was really expressing himself. When the President Salva Kiir came here, the State Department sent the letter of invitation for the President Salva Kiir to come. We received that letter on the October the 5th. And then the Ministry of Presidential Affairs in Southern Sudan wrote a letter to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Sudan that this is what should happen, that the first Vice President is going to visit the United States, take the necessary means so that to provide flight and arrangements, coordination with our embassy here in the United States. Then this resulted that the Republican Palace approved the visit for the President Salva to come here and provide President with the presidential flight to take him from Khartoum to Nairobi. And then when we were going to Nairobi, the President Salva Kiir was received by the ambassador of Sudan to Kenya in Nairobi. Then from there we came to Heathrow Airport in UK. Also we found the ambassador of Sudan waiting for the first vice president. And he stayed with us in the Heathrow Airport for 5 hours. Then we came to Dallas International Airport, Washington here. We found Ambassador John Ukit, I saw his name here, he's not here, to receive the first vice president with members of the embassy. And they received the vice president. Then three days ago, we heard that President Bashir was saying the visit of Salva Kiir is not legal. He doubted that visit. The Minister of Foreign Affairs of Sudan is not aware of that visit and looks at these facts. Receiving the old ambassadors where he stopped receive him, even in the United States, came to Nairobi, to Kenya, Nairobi, with the government flight, the presidential flight. And then you say also, his visit is not clear, the Foreign Affairs of Sudan was not involved in this visit. And also saying that the president was saying that Salva Kiir hasn't met with him, but Salva met with him and discussed his visit with the president, Bashir. And yet he was saying, no, the visit was not approved. Then there must be something going on wrong here. Somebody is lying here to the public. It's either the Foreign Affairs or the President Bashir through the media. Look at these facts. They can actually match what has been said, what they have been saying all this time, that the visit of Salva Kiir was actually done in a way of... And there's a letter actually from the State Department with the number of that letter. and yet they doubt in the visit.
This is the mentality that has been ruling Sudan since 1956. There's lack of seriousness. There's lack of truth. That's why we are in crisis now. How come the two president, the president and his vice, they meet and approve the visit, and at the end you say the visit is not clear, it's not approved? It's something.
Ruben, let me stop you there. I'm reminded that one of my colleagues says about the U.S. Institute of Peace that we're all about conflict. And clearly there are a lot of issues here, and we're pleased, frankly, to have them aired publicly between you. Let me take another questioner.
Hi, Kim Maynard, USAID. I'm just interested in two quick questions. One is, Ruben, perhaps you can give us an update on what's happening in former Western Kordofan and how that might play into the implementation of the CPA. And Tim, I'd be interested in if you could expand on your discussion about media and what role that plays in sort of furthering the implementation of CPA. Thanks.
Tim, you want to take that first on media?
Yeah, thank you very much. For my sins, I was at one point the head of internal media for a United Nations mission, the UN Transitional Authority in Cambodia. And it was crystal clear how vital a role media can play in informing the populace of their responsibilities, because it isn't just rights that people have. They also have to have responsibilities. And in the Sudan case, what I'm looking at, first of all, people need to know what the Comprehensive Peace Agreement does. Everybody generally knows that there's an election in 2009, and if you're a Southerner, you know there's a referendum in 2011. But what about what's deliverable out of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement? My impression is there are unrealistic expectations, in particular in the South, about what the agreement is going to deliver, how many chickens are going to be in each pot. And it seems to me that an effective media campaign could make people understand, or help people to understand, that deliverables in a part of Sudan that has such a terribly poor infrastructure, and the South lacks an infrastructure, not only a physical infrastructure. I mean, I've been on the road from Yambio to Maridi, and it was in weather like today, and it was just a hell of a mess. But there's a lack of infrastructure, of human infrastructure as well. And I know AID in particular has been very active with the EU and others in trying to train mid and senior officials. They started with negotiating training back in about 2002, as I recall. It's that kind of media effort aimed with, and I've just broached it, the need to do the kind of on-the-job training. There's a distinction, let me close here, a distinction between performance and capacity. And everybody in AID and CEDA, both the Canadian and the Swiss one, everybody talks about building capacity. Building capacity takes a long time. You're in Baghdad, where I spent 4 months this year, and everybody talks about building capacity. That's not what the southern people want. The northern people have got what they want immediately. They've got the performance. That's the word to seize on. They've got the performance they want. In the north, the performance is our sons and daughters aren't going off to fight and maybe die, killed or wounded. But for Southerners, you've got this whole set of, let's face it, the north of Sudan is a serious government. And sir, that is why you have more responsibility when it comes to implementation, because you are, in fact, what was the government before the government of national unity was created. This is not to let the Southerners off the hook. Let me quickly underscore. But when you're looking at performance, that's the problem. That's why Salva Kiir when he spoke to the Wilson Center last week, personally raised the issue of corruption, because nobody had either thought about it or dared to do it, not wanting to raise an embarrassing subject. So I have a question on corruption. Has the implementing legislation for the Anti-Corruption Committee passed yet? Because it hadn't as of the writing of this paper. The little, I took that and sort of...
Thank you, Tim. That's... Well, Reuben, I think the question to you was about Western Kordofan.
Yes, she asked what is actually happening in Western Kordofan in terms of security or insecurity or what?
Well, that, but just conditions and, the changes that seem to be going on and how that might impact
Yeah. Actually, not only the Western Kordofan, is the whole state of Kordofan and the far north, the Nubia at the north, and also even in the southern Sudan, the people are very angry at the government because they're not providing services, they're marginalizing its people, they're not helping, so everybody is now trying to, some are warming up really actually to take arms too, like Southerners and like the Darfurians. So I'm expecting if there's no change in the attitude and the behavior of the central government, then the everywhere in Sudan will be flaming really.
I need to hasten us on because we have some time limits today, so I'm going to take two questions at once, and if you could be brief, I think you're next.
Hi, I'm Marie Bazanson. I'm at the Wilson Center and the Kennedy School, and I have to say that after hearing the Vice President speak last week at the Wilson Center, I felt considerably more optimistic then than I do now. However, I do analysis both academically on long-range predictions about what could happen in the Sudan, as well as have worked extensively on the ground and was in Khartoum 2 months this summer and Khartoum and Darfur 2 months over the winter. So my question is, have both parties, and one thing I want to say is, since I'm not a diplomat, and I'm including all of you in having worked there, that I actually think it's rather miraculous that 66% of the CPA has been implemented, given how difficult it is to do things, and considering the bureaucracy and the operation that's extremely difficult. But looking in long-term predictions is what we've done academically, and I've spoken to the Darfur rebels about this, and I have not yet had the opportunity to speak to the Southerners. Have you thought about, you know, there are a lot of squabbles, there are a lot of things that need to be fixed now, that's clear. But in the long run, if there was some sort of a separation, then the area of the country has to completely rebuild bureaucracy. You have to go from a bureaucracy of military to one that operates. You'll be landlocked. There are tribal, which I'm supposed to not say, apparently, according to Tim, you know, there are tribal wars. There will be inequalities that will occur and war that will resume. So I think these thoughts are very, very critical to think about, and the Darfur rebels too. If they decided to secede, they'd be condemning themselves to desert landlocked with no economic development, no route, and no integration with your brothers that you've been fighting with. So that thought, I think, is something that people are failing to consider in the short-term squabble, that the long-term, the unity and the peace of the whole country is at stake here, as well as perhaps the entire Horn region.
Let me take another person.
Thank you. My name is Khalid Musa.
Can you speak up and right into the microphone?
Yeah, Khalid Musa, Embassy of Sudan. Thank you very much for the panelists, and especially for Ambassador Carney and Chin. They are one of the wisest voices in America about the issue of Sudan. The first question goes to both ambassadors. Is some American officials said publicly that America is not neutral about the situation and conflict in Sudan. How can that make them honest broker and good mediator to solve the problem in the Sudan? The second question goes to Mr. Mariel. Thank you very much for this interesting presentation. But I think facts always speak louder than rhetoric. I refer you to the UN report, which they say the rate of the deployment of the Sudanese armed forces to the north of 1965 boundaries is 78.6 till now. But on the SPLM side, it's only 7%. This is from the UN report. And the other question goes about the visit of the Vice President. I think, as you said in your presentation, that His Excellency the Vice President visited U.S. on the capacity as a Vice President here. But the question is, we did agree that the U.S. Embassy notified the government of Sudan, but that's not the question. The question is about the involvement of the embassy here and participation of the embassy here in the meeting, official meeting, who have been denied to get the official program and the meeting of the Vice President from the State Department. And the whole visit managed and coordinated by the SPLM office here. How can we deny to get involved in such a visit by our Vice President? Also, our primary representative in New York have been denied to attend any of the official program over there. But it came to us unofficially that the American permanent representative was the one that organized the whole meeting. So this is our Vice President, non-American Vice President. And well,
watching the time, I'm going to stop you there, and I'm going to ask, I'm going to go back through the panelists. Maybe we can go in reverse order and ask them not only to respond to these questions, but to say anything else that they would like to. We have to wrap up in about 5 minutes. Ruben?
I will answer Khalid. That actually, I didn't say that the Vice President visit was as he is a first Vice President of Sudan. I didn't say that. His visit here to the United States as a President of Southern Sudan. And that's why the mission of the government of Southern Sudan took over the responsibility and the State Department. Also, you said the SPLM office. There's no the SPLM office here. The mission that I'm working on is the mission of the government of Southern Sudan, not the SPLM mission or the SPLM office. In New York, the Vice President visited New York, and he met with the ambassador of our mission there in the UN. They went to the mission. They went to the mission and they met the ambassador. I'm not sure whether the ambassador went with them to meet the Secretary General or not. I'm not sure because I was here. But first, they went to the mission, to our mission of the UN in New York. Deployment of the troops. Maybe you're right, the UN statement is right. But you said the UN statement is about 78.9% has been already deployed to West North, and the rest are still in the South. By then, when the UN reported, then again the government redeployed the forces again to the South, especially to the oil fields in the South. And now it might be 78% again back to the South. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What is behind that you redeploying your forces back to the South and especially concentrating in the oil and in the oil fields? And not another area, northern Barghazal, for example, and other areas.
Right. Let's hold up till the very end, if you would. Can I ask, I think it's David's turn next.
This,
the question on this side of the room, I think to some extent, maybe we're looking at this as either a glass half full or a glass half empty. I attended the Sawalkir meeting also, and frankly, I left that session rather discouraged. I was not upbeat at all based on what I heard. You seem to be somewhat more upbeat, or at least more upbeat than you are at this meeting, and maybe there's good reason for that. You also mentioned that some, I think, 60% of the CPA has been implemented. I believe that was the statistic.
At the time I read it, it was 60% approved movement having been done, and I was looking at it at more than half full.
Okay. Well, I mean, you make a valid point that some elements of the CPA have been implemented, and we do, perhaps we have today, tended to overlook that. I mean, there have been some successes, and I think particularly on the security side, even though the issues that have been raised here today have been negative issues on the security side, there have been positive issues on the security side. So it is important to keep in mind that important elements of the CPA are underway and have been implemented. But I'm not sure how one parses percentages either, because one has to determine what are the important issues and what are the relatively insignificant issues. And I think of the really important issues, by and large, there's a long ways to go yet in terms of implementation. So I'm still, frankly, looking at that glass half empty. The question on the other side of the room about neutrality of American policy, I mean, we've got to be honest with ourselves. Any party engaged in a very heated dispute, whether it's the United States or the United Kingdom or China or Russia or whomever, they're never going to be totally neutral on it. That's just not the way the world works. And it may be that that's a little more the case in the United States than some places, because there are so many different forces pushing policy one direction or the other. And if you look at U.S. policy towards Sudan over the years, the influence has been very, very heavily from those domestic parts of American society, everything from elements of Capitol Hill to the religious right, to human rights organizations, to some extent, oil companies on the other side of the issue. It's been, by and large, a push in the direction of being rather sympathetic to the southern point of view, and I don't think anyone can dispute that. And to some degree, that's going to be reflected in executive branch policy, because that's the way the American system works. I'm not saying that that's the way it should always be, but that's the way it is. And I think the more important factor in the case of Sudan is that what the United States was trying to do, at least with the CPA, was a very positive thing, and that was to come up with some kind of solution to a very nasty, long-standing civil war. And to that extent, it worked. There was an agreement. It was a generally good agreement. All agreements have flaws, as this one does, but it was a serious effort, and not just by the United States, but by the United Kingdom and Norway and Italy and others. And I think that everyone who was involved in that effort deserves a lot of credit for it. I guess the real point I'm trying to make is we all like to think that we're always, always neutral, but we're not. And countries are not neutral, and no one's neutral. And I would just like to disabuse you of the idea that the United States is going to be neutral on just about any major policy. And for that matter, that would apply to just about any other country in the world.
Tim.
Let me take off on David's very articulate exposition on neutral by raising the term impartial. Now, impartial is actually the key term in the discussion, but it only applies to the United Nations. Only the United Nations is impartial in a dispute among countries, and when a UN mission goes to a country, as inshallah it will shortly go in large scale with the Africa Union to Darfur, as indeed there is a United Nations mission in Sudan now, UNMISS, to help implement the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. The UN is impartial. I have actually been in a couple of UN missions. I was impartial in one of them. In the other one, I was not part of the UN Secretariat, and I was therefore not required to be impartial. That was Somalia. I don't know what these particular U.S. officials said, and for their purposes here, it probably doesn't matter, because I can assure everyone in this room that the United States believed that
during the civil war in Sudan, the Southerners were the aggrieved party, that it was the North who was trying to control the South, and in doing so was not accepting that Southerners had political, human, and civil rights. But let's get to the real issue here. How, therefore, can the United States be an honest broker? And the answer to that question is a function of the situation and the country and the individuals engaged. If you look at Angola, for example, with all the support the U.S. gave to the late Jonas Savimbi, how could the U.S. ever have been an honest broker in bringing about peace in Angola? Yet we were, a peace that did not last, let me add. But you're an honest broker if the parties to the dispute accept you as such. And both the Sudanese parties, National Congress Party and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and Army, accepted the United States among the elements of the Troika as honest, and I've used the term facilitator in this paper. I think that's, if I can do a little parsing of that. On the larger question that Dr. Bezanson asked, yes, that's quite right. Sudanese need to start looking at what they want their children to inherit as a result of this peace agreement. And I think that's where you're going, and that's the key question. And that is why there is a strong recommendation in this paper that the international community and the regional aspect of the community, and I forgot to mention the South Africans, that all of those entities re-engage to assist you Sudanese to follow your best instincts and resolve this through full implementation.
I think the question, but it's got to be a very quick answer, is to you about what the Sudanese troops are doing in the oil fields.
Thank you for the question. I think the Sudanese troops are not reluctant to redeploy from the oil field, but under certain conditions that are very clearly stated in the CPA. That is, the SPLM forces right now would like just the armed forces, Sudanese armed forces, to withdraw and to come and take their position, and that is not true under the CPA. CPA said very clearly that integrated joint unit should be there. Until they agree to that, I think integrated joint unit should be deployed in the oil field, but not SPLM. Thank you.
Let me say that we're going to stop there. Clearly, there are a lot of issues remaining. I like to think of impartiality in somewhat different terms. I think of those who are in favor of the peace as being on the right side, and I hope there'll be both Northerners and Southerners on that side. Thank you all very much. Thank you very much to the panelists, and in particular to Tim for a wonderful report for USIP. Thank you.